We're going to give it to them.
This is Talk Sports with John Reed and Cody McClure.
Leave one wolf alive and the sheep are never safe.
Back in the booth, back on the airwaves, coming at you live from the Truly Hard Seltzer Studios, John Reed, Cam Black, no Cody McClure today, but we'll still try to have a fun show as we get set to talk sports and other things for the next 3 hours. Watch along on Periscope if you're into that type of thing. How are you today, Cameron?
I'm good, man. Typical Wednesday. Not much going on today. Just trying to get through the week. Hump day, hump day.
Yeah, I guess this is your last day of the week, right? You're headed to Atlanta afterwards?
Yeah, I am. Heading there, going to catch a Hawks game tomorrow night.
Okay.
Hawks Heat, so.
There you go.
Hawks Heat tomorrow night. So gonna catch that. Pumped to kind of see Trae Young after getting kind of screwed on the All-Star game.
Okay, so you're gonna go down, check the Hawks out for the first time this year.
Yep, have to catch at least one a year. I try to. Okay. So yeah, gonna go do that. But
first game after the All-Star break. Okay, not bad. Yep. All right. So this is your last show of the week. So nice of you to be here to help carry the load. So we'll try to get through these 3 hours. I do promise that it will be a better performance than what Tennessee basketball had last night. That was pretty tough. That was tough to watch. Like we talked about in the voluntary reaction presented by Miller Lite, you know, Roger called in and said, hey, the most important thing is Tennessee won. And I said, you know what, Roger? You were right about that. That is the most important thing.
Yeah, they needed that one for sure. If they have any hopes, they had to grind that one out and get the win, but yeah, it was not a pretty performance at all.
I mean, you know, tournament aside, which, you know, I kept saying that last night, but it feels kind of foolish to even, you know, really talk about the tournament right now, but you needed that one for the NIT.
Yeah.
And you needed that one to have people not completely check out on the basketball season, and as we're getting set up for a live watch party / live voluntary reaction on Saturday for the Auburn game at Hops and Hollers. You know, a loss there would have made that place really sad.
Man, yeah,
I don't think we could have really had anybody wanting to come out and talk hoops and watch hoops with us had Tennessee lost to Vanderbilt. It was a lethargic performance. I'm not going to panic with it. I didn't see anything last night that changed my mind about this team. Cam, you've been low on this team already, so did you see anything that changed?
No, not really. I did, when they made that, like, 12-0 run with, like, 2 minutes left, I thought that showed some fight there, and they realized, like, oh, it's go time. We need to go ahead and, like, finish this off. So I did like the urgency there to, you know, try and fight out for this win, but, yeah, besides that, nope, it still looks like the same team.
It's a deeply flawed team. It's a team without elite talent. We know that. I still maintain that I don't think Barnes has done a great job with this team, you know, even coaching it along the way. You saw some fire from him last night at halftime, at least, but it was more of the same kind of just really blaming the players, which whatever, the players needed to be blamed. They scored 28 points in that first half against Vanderbilt. But I don't think it changed my opinion on this team negatively either, just because it was a weird situation where you're coming off of a heartbreaking loss against South Carolina.
Yep.
A game that, you know, felt like a crucial loss. And it was a hard-fought loss. And it was a loss that you had after leading basically the entire game. So then you have to come back, and you know that you have a trip to Auburn on Saturday against a, you know, elite-level SEC team. I don't think Auburn's necessarily elite nationally, but elite in the conference. Mm-hmm. And then you have in sandwich between it your in-state rival, sure, Vanderbilt, but your in-state rival that's really, really bad at basketball.
Yeah, and to be honest, Vanderbilt had been playing better as of late. If you kind of take out that Florida game where they just kind of got beat down there, but like against Kentucky, Mississippi State, stuff like that, they were showing fight you hadn't seen from them earlier in the year. So I will give them credit for that, but also, yeah it's not a good team. Yeah.
Yeah, like, if I'm LSU, I'm embarrassed. Like, hey, we lost to I don't know how you tolerate being the team that lost to this Vanderbilt team, because they, you know, that game was 40 minutes last night, and for 32 of it, Vanderbilt looked like they didn't know how to play basketball.
Yeah.
They had some 8-minute stretch. They had an 8-minute stretch, you know, each and in each half, where they looked competent. They hit some open shots. They took advantage of some Tennessee turnovers. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, that team didn't look like it knew how to play basketball. I felt bad for Jerry Stackhouse. And I understand that as a college athlete, it would probably be tough to get up for that game.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Especially from our perspective, I would say, like, one, our hopes are kind of slim for a tournament, super slim for the tournament.
Right.
And you know how bad Vanderbilt is. So, yeah, I could definitely see how our team
and
is.
And knowing you've got a big game on Saturday, they call this the sandwich game, the schedule trap game. We looked at the schedule last year because I remembered a similar game last year. We won that game by 12, but we, you know, we lost to Kentucky, ranked number one in the country last year.
Yep.
On a Saturday, turned around, played a midweek game against Vanderbilt before we had to go back to LSU. We won by 12, but it was a like 58-46 type of performance, one that you just really slept walk through, and that team was awful. That Vanderbilt team, you know, winless in the SEC. This one's awful, but maybe a little bit better, or at least a little bit more competitive. They are playing a little bit harder for Jerry Stackhouse, I think, than they were for Bryce Drew last year. But, you know, even that team last year that was one of the best in the country had troubles in this situation. So I'm not surprised that this Tennessee team.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're not the best team either, so I'm not surprised it was a lot closer, but yeah, I'm just happy they grinded out the win, to be honest, because, yeah, this would have been a really bad loss for the team. Just like you said, like, not even tournament-wise, like NIT, just the look of the program and everything going forward.
The look of
the
program and the feel of the program, to me, would have been the biggest things. Like, missing the NIT tournament, whatever. Like, I don't think any of us are going to take solace in the fact of, hey, well, we didn't make the tournament, but we're a 3 seed in the NIT. We get that one home game where we could pack it out for $10 tickets to have people sit in the front row that don't usually get to sit there, that type of movement that we've had in the past. But just us trying to get through these last 5 regular season games and hopefully 2, 3, 4 SEC tournament games, it was big to not lose to Vanderbilt, because that would have been the worst loss of the season and the worst loss of the last 2 years for sure for Rick Barnes and the boys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, no, thank goodness they won that, because, it looked questionable for a minute. But, like I said, that 12-0 stretch was nice to see them kind of wake up for a moment and be like, okay, we need to make sure we finish this game off. I did like that fight there. But, yeah, besides that, it still looks like the same team. This last 5-game stretch is going to be tough. I don't know what really to expect there. I mean, they're not going to be favored in any of these games for sure.
No. We'll get to let me pull up the old last 5 games they have, and you look at the KenPom analytical ratings of what Tennessee should do down the stretch. It's saying basically 2-3 is where it's at right now. I'll get to that on the other side of the break. Anything that just stood out to you from this team performance and any individual performances? I thought John Fulkerson. I thought John Fulkerson played a really good second half. You know, he got to the halftime with 1 point, and he ended up scoring 16 second half points. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Tennessee looked better in the second half. You know, they still didn't look great, but they looked better in the second half. It looked like they had a little bit more of their normal game going. That's ran so much through John Fulkerson.
Yeah, he was big in the second half for sure. I don't like Josiah Jordan-James going scoreless. I don't know. I don't like that. I feel like he should be more aggressive, especially with the talent we think he has. I would like to see him be more aggressive in that aspect, because, yeah, when you bring in a 5-star guy, you don't expect him to go scoreless in games, especially when he plays 30 minutes. But besides that, yeah, it was just Fulkerson taking over in the second half, and like you said, the teams ran through him all season, and it continued to do that in the second half yesterday.
Yeah, we'll look at the upcoming 5 games, see what Tennessee projects to do I do think there's still a chance that this season can end with accomplishing some goals. Like I said, I'm not overreacting to a sluggish performance against a bad Vanderbilt team in the middle of the week on a 6:30 tip. We'll look at the remaining schedule, what Tennessee projects to do, what they need to do, and kind of talk about some more individual performances. Tennessee basketball played last night, so I guess it has to be the story of the day just because there's not much else going on. There was a couple of narratives around college basketball that I think play into Tennessee and play into some conversations we've had here. We'll visit some of those. Stick with us to talk sports on Fan Run Radio.
Citizens National Bank.
As Jared tweets in, Tennessee baseball won last night, so maybe we just focus on being a baseball school. You know, on one hand, I'm like, you know, I feel like we've done this seven straight years now where we win in the non-conference, get some hopes, and then we get to the conference, and we're like, okay, we're not that good. Now, last year was better. Last year you were better in conference, and it does seem like Vitello and the boys are going to continue to improve, but I have been impressed. Especially over the last three games. You know, the season opener, you won that one 3-0. But the last three games, Cam, you have won 19-0, 23-4, and 8-2.
Yeah, they're racking up the points.
So that's what, 50-6? Is that what that comes out to? 50-6?
Yeah, I think so, somewhere in there. But
over the last three games. Now, Western Illinois and Charlotte, I don't know how good they are, but I do know Tennessee has a real big test on Friday. Against Texas Tech, who I believe is number 6 in the country. I think I saw that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You're playing a tournament in Texas. So, you know, I don't know if there'll be a lot of Texas Tech fans there or whatever. I don't know if Tennessee fans travel. I don't know how these baseball tournaments really work because I know the Round Rock Classic has a bunch of teams there. So I don't know what the atmosphere will be like. But I do know Tennessee is going to have a test against Texas Tech. So, you know, I'll keep my eye on them Friday. Let's see how they perform. Let's see how it goes.
So far, so good. And like you said, they're putting up the points. The bats are hot.
Runs.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Not points.
I always forget there's a differential there, but yeah, runs.
I'm just helping you out. I'm not nitpicking. Yeah, no, we're growing together.
I appreciate it. But no, yeah, the bats are hot for sure. And that's always baseball's more fun when they're scoring, in my opinion. So I like that.
I think everyone feels that way about baseball, which is why you saw the MLB try to juice the balls and all that stuff. Yeah. I do think they're like, yeah, everyone likes scoring more. So I don't think you're alone there by any means.
Except in the playoffs. They took those away for some reason. But besides that, yeah.
That's a fair point. So Tennessee has 5 remaining games. If you just run through the KenPom odds, who is, you know, one of the go-to forces in college basketball analytics, he has Tennessee with a 28% chance against Auburn, a 32% chance against Arkansas, a 54% chance against Florida at home, 25% at Kentucky, which I don't feel very good about, and then a 52% chance against Auburn at home. So they have Tennessee at 2 wins. I do think you need 3 wins.
Yeah, I would agree there, and I don't know if I so much agree with exactly the games he has us winning. I would still think that Arkansas and Florida are our best shots.
I agree. But it does make me feel good about, okay, so at least we have a coin flip at home situation against Florida and Auburn, and I think my guy Ryan gave me the update that Isaiah Joe is supposed to be back for Arkansas this weekend.
Okay.
So that will, you know, it'll be a little bit different of an Arkansas team when we play them, but Isaiah Joe isn't some dominant big man, and Arkansas ain't going to get any taller, and they're still going to be, you know, 6'8 at the tallest. So that allows Tennessee to play its best matchup and not have to try to run out a big man out there against its will.
Yeah, and I'm not sure he can – if we play as well as we did against him last time, he's not going to make up that difference by himself, I wouldn't think. So, that would be a nice one to steal on the road for sure. Evan, yeah, if you can win your 2 home games – I think that's best case scenario for this team moving forward, to be honest. But
Tennessee,
and then going with some momentum to the tournament, maybe.
Yeah, I mean Tennessee at this point just needs to find itself in a position. I think where March matters.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll say even the end of February. And I think we're at that position, even with the loss to Auburn. You're at a position where you're like, okay, at least these games matter towards the end of the season. And you get to the SEC tournament, you're going to have one of two options. I guess we'll call it one of three options. Options one is to win the SEC tournament, which, you know, at Tennessee, we know better than that. Like, yeah. we don't win the SEC tournament. Tennessee hasn't done that since, what, 79? And we've had some really good teams along the way. So I don't expect this to be the team that ends that streak, needless to say. So that's option one. We'll call that one a long shot. Option two would be if Tennessee goes 2-3 down the stretch, they would probably have to win at least two SEC tournament games.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, anywhere from a 7-10 matchup, you know, 7-10, 8-9, that type of matchup would probably be where Tennessee would be in. You'd have to win that one and then upset the 1 or 2 seed.
Yeah.
Which is going to be tough, but it would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
Or Tennessee could go 3-2 and beat Arkansas on the road and hold serve at home against Florida and Auburn. And then just have to win the, you know, 7-10 matchup.
Yep.
Or the 8-9 matchup. Just win that one game, and you would probably be good enough to get in the tournament.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. And like you said, yeah, playing in March would be huge. Even if it's in the NIT, I think this team with the young players on the team, they need that kind of experience. Because even if you're in, like, the NIT, if you're a matchup against one of those smaller schools, they're playing hard. Because that's, like, you know, the thing for them, that's a big moment for them. That experience of getting those, you know, that all-out experience in March is good for these young players. And
yeah.
I think they could use that.
I mean, I guess of the young players, I mean, that's a whole other question. Is, like, of the youth, like, who do we even, like, really, truly care about? Like, who of the youth, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, although I guess it's going to come across that way, of the young players on this team, who do we think is going to actually play big minutes next year when things are supposed to be so much better? Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
This team's supposed to have higher aspirations. You're adding four new players that you think are going to play. You know, your three freshmen,
mm-hmm.
and Victor Bailey from Oregon, who, you know, is coming to Tennessee with the idea that he's going to play.
Yeah, I guess just Vescovi and Jordan James, Josiah Jordan James are probably the two names of the young guys that for sure should get some run next year.
Yeah.
Besides that, yeah, like you said, with the incoming people, everybody else may be buried.
that's the way it feels, and I feel like Vescovi's already ready. Which,
yeah.
You know, he wasn't great last night. I'm not going to come on here and act like he was. I want to say he had 6 turnovers. Is that correct? I think if you check the box score, you'll see he had 6 turnovers. Now, I'm also not going to punish him for having 6 turnovers because for long stretches of time he was on the court, which he played all 38, not all 38 minutes, but he played 38 minutes, as did Pons, by the way, who's dealing with a knee issue.
Yeah.
Vescovi played 38 minutes. I would say he played at least 30 of those minutes being the only person who could dribble a basketball for Tennessee.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like, maybe when Josiah Jordan James is out there for 13 minutes, maybe it's only 25 minutes for Vescovi, but a big portion of his minutes comes when Vescovi is the only guy on Tennessee who can dribble and make any type of offense for this team. So I'm not going to punish him for his turnovers. I'm not even going to label him as a turnover type of guy. Just because this, you know, the onus is on him so much. He has such a burden to try to, you know, create for this team.
Yeah, he's the only, like you said, he's the only ball handler and really the only playmaker with the ball. Josiah Jordan James does it a little bit too. Like, he's getting better at that. But yeah, Vescovi is running things for sure. So yeah, a lot's on him early on, and for the most part, he's handled it well. Like you said, turnovers. They've been happening with him all season. I think he's – and what is this? Like, he's not even really, like, 10 games into his career, is he? Like, somewhere in there? Like,
he's at least, what, 13, I guess? 13? He's played all conference games. So he's,
okay,
he's,
yeah,
he's,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
13.
But, yeah, like, still super young freshman.
But I will say –
used to it.
I will say I agree with you that Vescovi and James are in your plans for next year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not they're starters next year, like, because I could 100% see Josiah – be coming off the bench, especially if Pons is still here.
Absolutely, yeah. He's
now with Pons and Fulkerson. Obviously, we're not forgetting them. We're just saying they've already gotten their reps. They have some experience in big games,
mm-hmm.
In the SEC tournament, the NCAA tournament. Both those guys are a little bit more tested. But of the young guys like Kamwa, Bember, Uros, Gaines, I don't know how big of contributors they're going to be for you next year.
Yeah, I think they're just going to be depth guys that you can know have played and you know what you're going to get from them.
And I think depth guys will be important at the beginning of the year in some of these midweek games when the guys' legs are tired. Like, I do think Tennessee is going to finally have the benefit of being deep, because even last year when the team was so good, it didn't feel deep. So maybe you are developing some much-needed depth for next year when you're looking at potentially bringing Josiah Jordan James and maybe even Vescovi both off the bench. I don't think Vescovi will be coming off the bench because he's played so well, but you are bringing in at least two guys who can handle the rock pretty well.
Yeah. Best case, it takes some pressure off him regardless.
Yeah, but I mean, there's going to be an odd man out most likely between Vescovi and Victor Bailey, the transfer from Oregon. Yeah. And, one of those guys is going to have to come off the bench. Maybe it's Victor Bailey. Maybe it's Vescovi. I don't know. I haven't seen Victor Bailey play. I don't trust, and I'm not going to trust, and this has been another takeaway from this SEC conference play, is I'm not going to trust what I'm told when it comes to these players either, because, I mean, we were fed a lot of stuff about Uros, and I'm not going to pile on the guy, but he can't play right now.
They really pumped him up like he was going to be a difference maker when he hit the court.
I don't know if it was like trying to build in an excuse for Barnes. It felt like maybe a built-in excuse there, right? Or because like it was like, hey, this team's not going to be great, but man, if they had Uros cleared, this thing could have been a lot better. This could have been a tournament team, guys. It's okay. I don't know if that was the case, and then the NCAA is like, okay, fine, you're cleared, and then you're looking around, and you're like, oh, now he's going to play? Or if maybe he's just a practice player, because I do think if you believe in angels, you have to believe in demons. That's what I always tell my dad, at least.
Yeah.
So I do think if you believe in the idea that some players are not good at practice but good in games, like Josh Dobbs, for example, the gamer type, Cam.
Yeah.
If you believe in the gamer type, you also probably have to believe in the Nathan Peterman types of, like, really good in practice, gets in the game, doesn't know what he's doing. So maybe that's Uros. Maybe he plays good against Drew Pember.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If he's running with the starters and he's playing good against some of your scout guys, maybe he does look good. I just find that really hard to believe because we were told he had a lot of offensive skill and could shoot, and I've yet to see that.
He's airballing those little turnaround hook shots he tries to do.
Yeah, maybe he doesn't like playing that way. Maybe Rick Barnes is trying to Americanize him. Like, maybe Rick, what do we always say in the NBA about the European big men? They're skilled. Look at Porzingis. Like, let them shoot. Don't make them go in the post. Look at Dirk. Maybe he's gotten here, and Rick Barnes is like, hey, no, your big ass ain't shooting. Get down in the post. You got to go to work. And he's like, coach, I don't have a turnaround hook shot. Well, you better pretend you got one. You're 7 foot. Uros, get down there. Maybe there's some of that going on. I don't know. But whatever we're seeing so far in his career isn't working out. I'm not going to pile on the guy. He needs to, maybe he needs another year of development. However, just to kind of finish up the conversation we're having about who plays into next year's future, I don't know how much I'm counting on him next year either.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's just a big body that – you got probably if you just got somebody big to match up with, you just throw him at him, and like you usually say, he's got five fouls, so keep him there, big body to wear down somebody else's big body. But yeah, you don't really expect him to make a difference offensively, I would say, or even really defensively. He's just kind of there, kind of just in the way almost on defense wise. We were told he had an outside shot. Like I haven't said, seen the dude look at the rim when he's at, like, the three-point line.
Barnes is old school. Barnes is old school, right? Like, I mean, his favorite play last year was dump it down to Grant Williams in the post, which it was a really good play. You had a, all-SEC, SEC player of the year type of guy. Like, it worked with Grant Williams. We've seen at times his best play been like, hey, dump it down to Fulkerson, dump it down to Pons. Neither one of those guys have great post-up games, so maybe it's just maybe it's a Barnes thing. I don't know, but I haven't seen it from Uros.
Yeah, he's probably not getting a ton of run next year at all. Yeah,
I'm not banking on it. Like you said, maybe some matchup things if you're playing against big lineups, because you are going to need some size. But I have at this point, if we're just looking for next year, Kamwa, I have more confidence in him developing, and Pember putting on some weight and developing than I do Plavichuk figuring out how to play in the SEC.
Yeah, please put some weight on Pember.
Yeah, put some weight on Pember, but not too much. You know, I think he's going to need to be somebody that's a little bit more athletic because it's not like he's just really tall, but he's going to need to keep some athleticism, but he does need to gain some weight. That way he can bang, at least on defense down in the post.
Yeah, at least hold his own.
And Kamwa, like, I mean, that he's a project. We knew he was a project when we got him, so I'm going to give him a year to maybe develop. But I just have more confidence that he'll be a factor next year than I do Urosh. All right, that wraps up Tennessee basketball conversations, I guess. You know, Tennessee, we looked. I think they need to go 3-2. The odds of them doing that's probably about 33%, I would say.
Yeah, at best, yeah.
At best.
Yeah. I don't have a ton of confidence in this team, just from what we've seen, but it's doable. It's doable, so I we'll see how they perform down the stretch. Vanderbilt didn't give us a lot of hope, but
we'll be at Hops and Hollers live on Saturday watching the game. Come by, hang out, get on voluntary reaction, we'll talk about it. Stick with us, it's Talk Sports on Fan Run Radio.
My name is John Reed, and for years people made fun of me for not drinking beer. I tried to find some replacements, but they were all far too sugary and left me feeling bad. Lucky for me, I found Truly Hard Seltzer. It's refreshing with only 1 gram of sugar. You truly love to see it.
It's the dawn of a new game day, and Truly Hard Seltzer is subbing in for light beer. With 5% ABV, only 100 calories, and that's light and refreshing. Game day with Truly Hard Seltzer. Drink what you truly want. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, drink responsibly. I'm bringing sexy
back. So Jason Witten says he is open to playing other places. So he's basically, Cam, was he saying that he is playing this year? Like, that's the plan?
Yeah, he said his plan is to play this year, and they asked him, and he said obviously he wants to finish it out with the Cowboys, but he said sometimes that's not in his, you know, that's the kind of thing not in your control all the time, so he'd be open to playing elsewhere.
How do we feel about this? Because in football, very rarely does someone get to play their entire career, especially if it's a long career with the same team.
Yeah, I usually respect it when they do, but like you said, it's super rare. And what's he been, 16 seasons for the Cowboys, I think he's played. But yeah, it's a business, and that's kind of, it makes it tough to do that. And I don't know what the Cowboys have. I don't know if they have any other tight ends there, if they're going to think about drafting one or what their plan is.
Is it Swain? Is Swain their other tight end's name? Yeah, I feel Swain. Like they actually got better tight ends than Witten, and like they quit using them to use Witten. Like I get it from a Cowboys perspective. Like I think Witten, with all due respect to you know, one of the best tight ends, I won't call him one of the greatest tight ends, but one of the best tight ends of the last, you know, two decades. Like, he played at a good level since 2003.
Absolutely.
But if I'm the Cowboys, I'm kind of like, you're not really helping this team. Like, the locker room leadership, we appreciate it. But when it comes just to, like, on-field production, I'm not sure that we can pay you enough money to, like, make it worth your while. Like,
yeah, and like you said, they have other tight ends, and it's probably kind of holding them back. Because if you bring him in, you got to play him.
Like, unsurprisingly, last year was the lowest output of his career outside of his rookie year. Like, I don't think that's any surprise to anybody. But it's sad when you think about, you know, the NFL has never been more pass happy. You know what I mean? Like, Dak Prescott threw for a whole lot of yards, and Witten only had 529 of them, and only 4 touchdowns. He's never really been a big touchdown guy, but only 4 touchdowns.
Well, who would you rather have, Olsen or Witten?
Olsen.
Yeah, me too. I don't think that's,
but I mean, I don't know how much of a difference there's going to be. Like, I don't know how much Olsen has left in the tank. Like, when you just look, like, what I will say about Witten is that, and this is in large part why his overall numbers are really good and are favorable to most tight ends. Now, he's not going to be able to reach the top of the top when it comes to Gronk and Gates and Gonzalez and stuff, but everyone else Witten has a good claim against, because outside of the year he retired, he hadn't missed a game since, you know, his second year. And even then, I don't think he missed a game. It's just that he didn't start the game. He played 16 games. He played 16 games every year outside of his rookie season and the year he retired, and only missed one start, which I don't know why he didn't start. I don't know if it was just a situation where they had a different tight end in 2004. Yeah. I don't know. But he started basically every game of his career outside of his rookie year and the year he retired. So the longevity has been there. But also, Cam, to your point, it's hard to take a guy like that who's used to playing when he's on the team to be like, hey, you're going to be our situational, like, emergency special teams tight end type of thing.
Yeah, that's like one of the things where he just threatened to retire again. I feel like at that point, there's no point in really signing up for it if you're not getting to play. And like he said in some of his quotes, he's like, I still feel like I have something to give. So yeah, he wants to play. But yeah, I don't know if the Cowboys want to keep holding on to him like that, or they're gonna let him walk and, you know, move on and see if he latches on somewhere else. He also said he does want to, like, coach in the future.
He does want to coach in the future?
He said, I think coaching is in the future, was one of the quotes he said.
See, that's what, like, that the thought, I mean, there's rumors about Jason Witten as far, you know, before the year about him, like, coming back to take over the Cowboys, like how they would just transition him into Jason Garrett's role. Like, that's what type of respect they thought the Cowboys had for him. So that's why I wonder, like, is it even worth, like, playing one more year at a, let's face it, not your normal level? Like, I don't think Jason Witten at 38 is going to bounce back and be a great tight end again. Like, I just think that's really hard to do at that age. You know, when you've played 17 years. Is there does he mention anything about the allure of chasing a ring? Is he wanting to ring chase?
Not in any of the quotes I saw. He was just like, I would prefer to be a Cowboy, but I know it doesn't always work that way. No coaching's in the future, but I want to play while I can. It's basically what he said. So.
Yeah. I don't know what the market for him would be.
Yeah, I feel like it'd be better for him just to take like a low-paying coaching gig with the Cowboys, like some sort of assistant role they can just give him and test out the coaching ranks, you know, if that's what he really wants to do in the future.
Yeah, that's what – but, I mean, I guess if you think you can still play and like he says he wants to play, like, look, I don't think, as long as he doesn't go to, like, the Eagles or the Giants, that he would be, like, burning the bridge with the Cowboys. And even if he did, I think ultimately he wouldn't be burning that bridge. You see that all the time in football. But it is going to be weird to see him go somewhere, because I do think you're going to see it always worries me with these older guys especially, and it's something we've discussed with Tom Brady, right? Like, if you're Tom Brady and you're looking at your next move, like, I can't get past the comfort of knowing, like, if I'm washed and it's over for me, who do I want to be washed in front of? Somebody, a fan base that loves me and respects me and still, you know, will defend me till the end? Or do I go somewhere else where they have unfair expectations of me and they're much crueler to me? Because if Brady goes somewhere else and, you know, his potential destinations like Tampa Bay and the Chargers, they're not going to be too hard on him. The fan bases don't seem too hard. But I can't imagine the Raiders are going to be very nice to him. I know they're moving. I know they're not going to be in the black hole. But, like, their fan base is still going to be relatively the same fan base, right? Like, on game days, the black hole is still going to be there in Las Vegas.
Yeah, even if they weren't living in Oakland. If they're a Raiders fan and they're going to those games, same crowd.
I don't imagine them wrapping their arms around Tom Brady and saying, it's okay, man.
You're Brady. It's all right.
Yeah, it's okay. Thank you for everything you've done, because you know what? He will have not done anything for them. That's why I keep coming back to that with Brady. Like, I know that he's a professional. I know he's one of the best competitors ever. I know that he has this drive and he thinks he can still do it, but what if you don't?
Yeah.
What if you don't? Because I know we look at Joe Montana and the way he went from the 49ers to the Chiefs, and it was even a decent story. He went and got the Chiefs to the playoffs. He was 6 years younger than Tom Brady was whenever Tom Brady is going to be faced with this decision over the next month.
Yeah, and I don't think from his perspective he's worried about not being good enough, because, you know, he's done it, and I think he has confidence in himself. But, yeah, as either a fan base getting him or just looking from the outside in, like, yeah, what if he goes somewhere else and he's nowhere close to anything you expect?
With Witten, there won't be as much pressure. I don't think him going anywhere would really get people excited. Mm-hmm. I mean, strangely enough, if he does become a free agent and Brady stays in New England, like Brady, they're so devoid of any quality tight ends in New England, it might make sense for them to call Witten.
Yeah, slick, yeah.
And just be like, hey, Jason, you know what to do. You know how to run and catch 8-yard passes. We've had trouble with finding tight ends that could do that since Gronk retired. But I don't think that's moving the needle for Brady when the whole I need help thing.
They need to go ahead and just first round draft a tight end again.
The Patriots?
Yeah.
You don't draft a quarterback this year? Because I feel like you kind of have to draft a quarterback this year for the Patriots, but at the same time, I can't imagine selling that to Brady. Like, hey, come back. We're going to get you help. He's like, okay, you're going to draft a wide receiver again in the first round? No, I'm not going to do that. What a tight end? You know, there's this good guy at Iowa. I'm sure we could draft somebody from Iowa. Those guys are usually pretty good.
That's
no,
the name.
Not doing that. Left tackle? That guy from Georgia keeps getting hurt. Isaiah Wynn. No. Draft a quarterback, Tom. Oh, okay. I guess that's going to be okay. It's like I don't know how you sell that, but if you're New England, you do think I would probably try to grab a tight, probably try to grab a quarterback here.
Yeah, and I mean they don't have their second round pick, so I guess they would go quarterback first round and then go from there.
Maybe not. Maybe just go all in. Although it doesn't seem like Belichick's mantra to go all in and get caught flat footed. Like this is one of the few, I don't want to call it a get out of jail free card, but this is one of the few off seasons where it does seem like there are going to be enough quarterbacks available. That way, if you don't want to have to draft one, you could take a stopgap for 3 or 4 years or at least 2 or 3 years. There's enough options out there now where you could draft somebody and be like, okay, we'll draft a quarterback next year. But obviously the Patriots aren't going to sign one of those quarterbacks, make them sit behind Tom Brady, then draft a quarterback. Like, that's not going to work. Right? Like, it's not like they can sign Teddy Bridgewater to come be like, hey, you can come be our backup in New England and maybe you can get the job next year. I wouldn't imagine that would happen.
No. He'll have too many suitors, I would think.
Maybe Marcus Mariota?
Yeah.
Like, maybe if you're New England, you're like, okay, we'll sign Mariota. We'll maybe try to, you know, fix him. Let Josh McDaniels try to fix him. Mentally, physically, you know, just the way he plays, teach him some things. Then maybe if Brady steps away, you maybe have found a guy that's pretty talented that was good enough to be the second overall pick. And, you know, maybe you've got him to where you could at least
serviceable.
Yeah. Use him the next year as you try to draft a quarterback. Maybe that would be the route.
Yeah. I think that would be best case for them. I don't know how much they like Stidham. Maybe they actually really like Stidham and just like, hey, like, maybe we get you, Brady. Maybe we don't. We got Stidham here. We're not super concerned. But, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I'm pumped for the offseason.
Dallas tweets in saying, I will say that Witten is holding the Cowboys back now, but to act like he's not a top tight end of all time is weird. Only 4 tight ends have more touchdowns and only 1 has more yards. Says he probably puts him at 4th or 5th all time. I just don't know how you put him 4th or 5th all time when look, it's no disrespect. I'm not trying to disrespect Jason Witten and his legacy. Like he's a really good tight end, but to call him 4th or 5th all time seems absurd to me whenever like Gronk exists. Kelsey and I think Kittle will both go down as much better than him. I think Antonio Gates, Tony Gonzalez, like those are 3 from his era that I think were clearly better than him with Gronk, Gates, and Gonzalez. I know we're forgetting people. Like,
I mean, you go like Sharp and
Shannon Sharp. Yeah, Shannon Sharp. And who was the next? Who was the next?
Was
we said
Dicka.
Oh yeah, I don't know enough about the '80s to even before then he was coaching the '80s. So like I don't even know like going back that far. But like I know people feel really strong about Kellen Winslow Sr. Again, I'm not going to pretend like I know about them. I'm just kind of sticking in the era we've watched. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Shannon Sharp probably gets a lot of respect for being better. Again, it's no disrespect.
Yeah, he's great, but he's I don't know about top 5.
And when you start looking at, he's got the most yards. Okay, well, that's fine. Like there is a portion of when you're looking at all-time statistics though that you have to say, well, how many opportunities did he have?
Yeah, longevity-wise, he's tops for sure. Like he's been there.
And longevity is important, but like how much do you weigh longevity versus like the peak?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like when you just look at the peak of like what they did. Because, like, Kareem, longevity-wise, you know, Michael Jordan can't touch him. But no one's really saying that Kareem was better than Jordan. Same as, like, Karl Malone. Like, Karl Malone hung around. You know, Karl Malone's a better example than, Kareem, because Kareem was obviously awesome. But Karl Malone stuck around for 20 years and is 2nd all-time in points scored. And no one's really giving Karl Malone credit of being one of the all-time great scorers or one of the all-time, you know, all-time greats. When I say that, I mean like a top 5 scorer or a top 10 player overall. No one feels that way about Karl Malone.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
Again, not trying to besmirch Jason Witten, but zero seasons of double-digit touchdowns? That has to matter, right?
Yeah.
Like not having any seasons with double-digit touchdowns?
Yeah.
Don't most of the greats have that? Like, I mean, if I pull up Antonio Gates, are we not pretty confident that Antonio Gates has had multiple seasons with double-digit touchdowns?
Yeah, I would bet money on that, yeah.
I know Gronk has. I mean, yeah, Gates has one, two, three, four of those. 2010, Gates had 10 touchdowns in 10 games. That was pretty impressive.
Jeez.
So, again, I'm not trying to, be hateful. I thought I was being fair when I said he was one of the top five tight ends of this era and a really good tight end. To call him top four or five all time just seems a little homerish to me.
Yeah.
Just me personally. Yeah, the Tennessee ties mixed in with the Cowboys being such a big brand. That's just where I'm at on it. But
yeah, I think the brand does help him too. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
That aspect.
We'll see what happens with Jason Witt moving forward and with Tom Brady. Maybe they end up playing together somewhere. It's Talk Sports on Fan Run Radio.
My name is John Reed.
We've had some Braves news over the last couple days we haven't really touched on, but the Atlanta Braves, I guess, extended both their manager and GM. And then today I'm seeing, coming across just now, that Fox Sports South is parting ways with sideline reporter Kelsey Wingert. Doesn't she do some Hawks games, Cam? Like, I don't know if she does, like, the sideline reporting, but I think she's done some Fox Sports South, like, they go back at the beginning of the fourth quarter or post-game stuff.
Yeah,
I feel like she's done some of that.
I think I've seen her on that too, yeah.
I know the Braves fans I follow all like that Kelsey girl, mostly because she has an attractive Avi, but she seems like she did a pretty good job of connecting with fans. But just coming across, she is not going to be doing the sideline reporting, which, the article from The Athletic notes that this decision is unusual, given that spring training is already underway. And that the Braves had previously said there would be no changes made to the organization.
Hmm. Interesting.
I don't know if there's some drama there or what, but either way, the Braves are going to be bringing in a new sideline reporter. Rob Manfred has been getting it from all over.
Oh, everywhere, yeah.
From all over, like from the typical loudmouths of baseball to the quiet guys like Mike Trout and Nick Markakis. And he made it worse whenever he talked about, I'm not going to take the trophy away because it's just a piece of metal. And you've had a lot of players saying, hey, that's really disrespectful. To the point where even you had LeBron James noting, I am in sports.
Yeah.
I may not play baseball, but I am in sports. That is one way to put it, LeBron. You are in sports with a capital S.
I have sported before.
I know a thing or two about sports, okay? I'm LeBron James. I'm in sports. And then he popped off the worst hashtag of all time. It was like really long and
yeah.
I don't even remember what it was, but there weren't very many other things that people could search on the hashtag like to find at the time.
Yeah, he's kind of cringy to me when he tweets like that.
you see the strong dad energy with LeBron.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But no, yeah, he was he had some strong takes on it, too. It sounded like he was basically saying, have open season on the Astros players.
Mixed in with, like, he's talking about the players had control. I don't know if he was, like, trying to tell the players to boycott the games until the trophy's gone. Like, I don't know. There's a part of it like, hey, beat the Astros' ass. That's what I would do. Mixed in with, you have all the power. Maybe just don't show up to the games. I don't know what he was going for, but Rob Manfred has put out an apology for saying, hey, it is a, just a, quote, piece of metal.
Oh, man. Yeah, LeBron was like, it's uncontrollable about what I would/could do. Like, dude, chill out. Like, don't, yeah, he's basically saying fair game. Fair game with the Astros. But, yeah, no, good you did that apology, I guess. I don't think it means much now. You know,
what are your thoughts on taking the championship away? Because I understood his defense, and his defense was basically me saying that they didn't win the championship isn't going to take back their celebration. It isn't going to take back the memories of that season. If you remember the season, you are going to remember the Astros won. Mm-hmm. It's so from that respect, I kind of understood what he was saying. However, is baseball not all predicated, like, on trying to protect the past? Like, on trying to protect the record books and trying to protect the integrity of the game to an extent and, like, trying to tell the story of the game through history? That's why they're so, like, you know, that's why the steroids were such a problem, because it just tainted their comparisons of Hank Aaron and Babe Ruth. It made it seem unfair that they had hit so many more home runs than those older guys.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I would take it away, per se, because I don't think you can also just award it to somebody, in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if, like, yeah, I do think they're kind of trying to protect the history. But, yeah, I don't know, because, yeah, like I said, I don't know what you could do with it if you take it away, because I feel like you almost have to give it to somebody, and I feel like it's not entirely fair, too, just to give it to the team they were playing. Because, hey, if somebody else had made it instead of the Astros, who knows what could have happened. So, I don't know. It's kind of a weird, tough situation, but he's handling it really poorly.
Oh, no, he's
saying the wrong thing.
He's making everybody mad. Like, no one is happy in this. I mean, I guess the Astros sort of kind of are because they got their championship. But it's a situation that everyone every time someone talks, it gets worse.
Yeah, he should have just released, like, one statement at the beginning of this about, like, if they were going to, you know, if they weren't going to take away the trophy, yada, 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 and just left it at that. But, yeah, no, he keeps trying to save himself by still talking, and it's backfiring big time. So
That's not going well.
Yeah, not at all.
It's not going well. It's going to keep continuing. It's going to keep, you know, he's in a bad situation now because I don't think he can, like, can he give into the pressure here?
I wouldn't be surprised if he did, to try and save the image a little bit, because I feel like he's getting blasted from every direction. Maybe he panics, maybe he folds, and yeah, he does give into it, but I don't know. Like,
usually you don't give in to public pressure, and like you don't come back and say, fine, I guess after all, enough people complained, okay, fine, we're going to take the trophy away, Astros. You have an official asterisk. Which is kind of funny because a coach that's in the news today, John Beilein, is involved in a similar story where, you know, they did take the trophy away from Louisville in that national championship game that, you know, he got beat in, where he could have been a national champion. They took the trophy away there. It's not like John Beilein's getting to call himself a national championship coach.
Yeah, that was
coach,
my thing
though.
With it. Like, they're not going to just hand it to. That's why I think it's weird about the taking it away, because you can't just hand it to the other team,
right?
Because they could have lost to whoever else would have made it, stuff like that. So
there's a John Beilein expose in The Athletic that had some interesting nuggets as he is officially out in Cleveland. We'll talk about that next. All right. So yesterday we had a. What do we have yesterday? We had a movement, I guess, the ACC announcing their support, Cameron, for, I guess, a new transfer rule that's being discussed right now. Is that what's happened?
Yeah, there's the NCAA Division I Transfer Waiver Working Group, is, I guess, whatever the group is called.
Okay.
They've been dabbling with a concept that would allow athletes to transfer one time without penalty, so you wouldn't have to sit out a year, anything like that.
Isn't that already the rule for non-revenue sports, basically? Isn't that already the rule, like, in sports that aren't basketball and football? I feel like across the lower level.
They allow it in all but five sports, and that's football.
Women's basketball, men's basketball, football.
Baseball and ice hockey.
Baseball and hockey, which, I mean, we laugh at hockey here, but hockey in the Big Ten.
They take it serious.
Yeah.
But besides those five sports, like you said, like, it's already a thing. Where you can transfer. But, so those five sports, though, don't allow it. And like you said, they were talking about yesterday, and the ACC came out and voiced its support for it.
So the ACC would be the second major conference that has backed them, because the Big Ten had previously backed them.
Mm-hmm. So it's just, yeah, it's starting to get some run. Starting to get people's support for sure. And you saw stuff like, I think Mark Richt was on Twitter yesterday complaining about this, saying that would be a free-for-all and wasting his time. Like
How he would have to, or I mean, not him because he doesn't coach anymore, but basically talking about how the other coaches would have to develop fringe players and then have them come be plucked by the bigger schools.
Yep.
Which I do think that would be a concern, right? Like this would hurt if you're a Group 5 school for sure. Or if you are a Vanderbilt or, I still am conditioned to say Kentucky. I know Kentucky fans would argue that they are above this. But if you're a Kentucky player.
Oh, yeah.
Or if you are a backup at any SEC school.
Yeah, no, it's definitely bad for – could be bad for some of those smaller schools, like you said. Because, yeah, if you end up being, like, a stud at, like, you're over at, like, Charlotte and you end up being a stud and you're like, well, shoot, like, oh, Clemson's calling my phone? Like, they want me? Well, why not transfer? Like, I'm not going to have to sit out. Could go win a title, something like that. So, yeah, it's it could hurt those smaller programs. Make it harder to, hold on to the big talent, but – at the same time, it does kind of help the big time players if they like need to transfer for some reason. They don't have to lose out on a year.
It takes all the judgment away from the NCAA, which mm-hmm. has been a cluster, right?
Yeah.
Since it's happened, like in terms of the consistency and how it gets judged, and well, this guy can go, this guy can't. Yeah, I know you want to watch your dying grandfather. You want your dying grandfather to watch you play football. Sorry, you don't get cleared. Mm-hmm. Okay, Justin Fields, you want to go to Powerhouse Ohio State? Sure, buddy, go ahead and do it. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and it's kind of like hypocritical that the coaches are the ones like, oh, this is so bad. Oh, you can go wherever you want, whenever you want. That's crazy. When that's exactly what they do.
The
time.
I mean, I guess Mark Richt. He got fired from Georgia before he went to Miami, so maybe he like is okay in terms of being the poster boy to complain against this. But I would assume that at some point during his time, at Georgia, he took some transfers.
Oh, I bet, absolutely.
Was it Lambert or whatever from mm-hmm, Virginia that year? Granted, he was a grad transfer and it's a little different, but it's always those coaches. Justin Fuente was talking about how they don't even look at the transfer portal because they don't want those type of guys. He was talking about that on signing day. And we're just like, Justin Fuente, dude, we all know you just tried to go interview for that Baylor job. Like, what are you talking about, bro? But I do feel like I get the cautiousness of opening up just a one-time free agency thing because you would feel like, hey, if we're going to develop these guys, they're going to leave to go to a better school. And that's just going to keep the rich rich and the poor poor type of thing. But I feel like in college football, we already have the rich is rich and the poor is poor. It doesn't feel like there are very many teams that come out of nowhere to win. At least win big.
Yeah.
It feels like we already have that system in place of the rich is rich and the poor is poor. I think ultimately, Cam, it comes down to the NCAA and these teams that oppose this want some type of commitment. And want some type of rule that treats these players as if they are not regular students. Or, excuse me, as if they are regular students and not employees. Whereas we all kind of know that the NCAA is trying to tell us that these players aren't employees because, there's no money being given to them. So they want to treat them like, no, these students are free to come and go as they please. They're not employees. They don't have any type of responsibility outside of, okay, here's your scholarship if you play. Yet they're trying to, if you are opposing this, it does seem like you would be trying to punish the students and treat them like employees, like they owe you a 3 or 4 year contract, right?
Yeah.
The scholarships are year to year, but when you come here, you're supposed to be giving us at least 4 years. You promised us 4 years. Like, you can't just be leaving us. Whereas we know that any student if you're at UT and you're like, you know what, all of a sudden I want to go to Alabama, or I want to go to MTSU, I want to transfer, there's not really much they can do to stop you.
Yeah, and like I was going to say, is it possible they start trying to write stuff into, like, the scholarship offers? And like, hey, like, and then that could be a whole other thing for recruiting.
Well, I don't think so, because ultimately these conferences supporting this isn't going to make much of a difference, because it does still come down to the NCAA.
Yeah.
Right, so the ACC and Big Ten can scream that they support this, but if their players transfer, they're not going to be eligible unless the NCAA deems them eligible. So in that respect, I don't think you're going to have anybody – when you say writing it into the scholarships, do you mean like for the saying that you're free to go or saying that you're not free to go? Because either way, it's going to come down to the NCAA. But it does seem like these conferences are trying to get out ahead of this, saying they support it. I don't know if the Big Ten's heart's in the right place, or if they want to say, hey, here, coaches, go use this, that we care about the athlete more than the SEC, or if they're just trying to make this less of a headache. Because I would imagine – that here in Knoxville, Philip Fulmer having to deal with Urosh and having to deal with Aubrey Solomon, that was a big headache for him.
Oh, absolutely.
Trying to get these players cleared. I would imagine that goes a lot, you know, that goes on in every single athletic department in the Power Five, in the Group Five, where you're getting these transfers in and they want to be eligible immediately and you're having to wait on the NCAA. Like Jeremy Pruitt and Tennessee, you know, we know they started the season off slow. Right? Mm-hmm. We know they started the season off slow with losses to Georgia State and BYU. They were also, you know, while they're getting ready for the season, we're having to deal with, well, are we going to have our starting nose tackle?
Yeah.
Because you didn't know like, up until the week of the game, remember? Like, yeah, it went all the way up to, like, the last week. And you didn't know if you're going to have your starting nose tackle. And I want to say in the last practice reports leading up to him getting cleared, he was back to scout team. Running with the scout team because you had to get other bodies ready. And I'm, of course, not using that as an excuse, but I'm using it simply to point out that, you know, sometimes these schools are having to just be left in limbo. Before the college basketball season, like, I want to say only 30% of the transfer waivers had been either granted or denied, and, like, 70% of people are still waiting on an answer, including Urosh Plavich, which, you know, in hindsight, we didn't really – need him that much, yeah, but you were still waiting, and still, the fans were in limbo, and the player was in limbo, and ultimately it comes down to the, you know, what's best for the players. In a perfect world, it's what's best for the players and what's best for the overall product. Like, you need to work hand-in-hand on that.
Yeah, it is insane that, like, they don't have an efficient enough system to get, like Urosh, for example. You don't find out till halfway through the season. Like, I feel like when it comes to, like, players' eligibilities, if they really were caring about the players, they would make sure they had a ruling before the season so they could either get them to the field on time, not – because, like, he lost half a year waiting on that decision. And if that happens all the time, and like you said, they were super behind on their stuff, so it's not like it's something new. It does happen all the time. It's just wasting people's careers.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, again, these conferences can come out and they're probably going to spin it and say, look, guys, look, future prospects, like, we care about you. We want you to be able to leave with impunity. But there's also a part of them that's probably like, man, we just need to make this simpler for everybody involved. We need, like, if I'm the NCAA, I sign off on this just because I'm tired of being painted as the bad guy.
And I'm
tired of having to take this case by case. And some of these are stupid, and we have to deny them, or some of these are stupid, and we advance them just because of politics or whatever. Just give me a uniform rule. One time, everybody goes. You get no restrictions. Just go. Will it be like a free agency? Yeah, maybe. But it's not like you aren't having examples of guys doing that now. It's not like Justin Fields didn't just walk out of Georgia and right into the playoff for Ohio State.
Yeah, hurts. Like, well, you know, grad transfer's different, yeah. But still – like, yeah, everybody transferring around.
Just make the same rule for everybody, and it would become simpler. Then you would, you know, then if you have a uniform rule, and you're like, the second time, no matter if you're a grad transfer or what, you can't do it. You can't transfer again. One transfer. That's it. Next one, you have to sit out. Like, no questions asked. Seems like common sense. Now that the ACC is behind it, it does seem like it's going to continue to gain momentum.
Yeah, like you said, it'll take a lot of pressure off them, so I don't see why they wouldn't, you know, keep pushing it.
All right, what animals do we have for Cam's Animal Kingdom?
All right, so I got the pink fairy armadillo.
Pink fairy armadillo.
Yep. Bearded vultures.
Bearded vultures?
Yep. And the eye-eye.
Have we done the before?
We didn't do it, but y'all saw a picture of it.
Okay.
And I'm going to follow up with that.
Okay, sounds good. Let's go to Cam's Animal Kingdom coming up next. No overrated, underrated. It would be dumb if I played that by myself, and Cam has to ask the question. So maybe we'll push that back to Friday when Cody is back. All right, we'll take a trip to Cam's Animal Kingdom next.
It's the best time of year.
Hey, I'm Steve Irwin.
Holy smokes, that was too close. Danger, danger, danger.
All right, let's take a trip to Cam's Animal Kingdom. We got the, let's see what we got. We got the Pink Fair Armadillo, the Bearded Vulture, and the Aye-Aye. Where are we starting?
We're going to start with the Pink Fairy Armadillo.
Pink Fair Armadillo.
So they are native to Argentina. That's the only place you can really find them. They're a desert animal, and they're the smallest armadillo in the world. They only get about 3.5 to 4.5 inches long. Super tiny. They only weigh about 4 ounces and live about 5 to 10 years.
Okay.
They eat a bunch of insects and stuff like that, only native to deserts, which makes it tough for them to live anywhere else because they're so specialized to living in the desert and things like that. They're really hard to keep in captivity, so like you don't really see them in zoos or anything. They die really quick. I think the longest I ever kept one alive in captivity was like 4 years. But it's tough to keep them alive in captivity. They're super nocturnal. They're good with different temperature changes because being in deserts, like if you know anything about deserts, they get super hot during the day and usually pretty cold at night.
Why are they pink? Is it a way to try to mix in with the ground, I guess, of the desert?
Nope.
The clay?
It's, you can see the blood vessels right under its shell. And so the blood vessels give it the pink coloring. So if their blood is like a darker color red, you know, with different like how... What's it like? Temperature and how many nutrients they've had and things like that will kind of adjust how red your blood can be, and that will adjust how pink their shell is or their shell. And they're actually the only armadillo whose shell is separate from like the body entirely. Like most armadillos, the shell is like completely part of their body. Theirs just runs across their spine, covers their entire back. They can still roll into a ball. All those things. And, they're just super cool because they're super small and smallest armadillo. Super rare. They actually don't know if they're endangered or not because they're so rare to find anyways that people have no idea how to, like, get an accurate number count on them.
So we have no idea how many there are of these?
Nope. But they're really specialized. And like I said, they're just in Argentina. So there can't be, you know, a super ton of them. But, that's the pink fairy armadillo.
Do they provide any purpose?
No, they just keep insects in the desert and
right,
things like that.
Right, but nothing.
Like,
no, we don't use them
for
anything. Yeah,
they tried to do a lot of, like, exotic animal trading with them for a while, but like I said, they're really hard to keep in captivity, so that died pretty quickly because, like, people liked it because of the little small, cute pink color. It was one of those popular, like, pet things, but, you can't really keep them alive in captivity, so, yep, we don't do much besides maybe run into them sometimes at night in the Argentinian desert. But all right, we got the Bearded Vulture, and these have a German name I can't pronounce, which means lamb vulture.
Okay, so let's go to this. What was this one called?
The Bearded Vulture.
Bearded Vulture. The pink armadillo, pink fairy armadillo didn't do it for me.
Yeah, I had a couple people request it, so I had to...
I saw that. Why did so many people request that? Was it something in the news about them? Or?
Not sure, but yeah, so I threw it in there for them. The Bearded Vulture... These are native to Europe. They're the largest old world vulture. They get about 4 feet tall.
Now this is a cool-looking bird.
Yeah, they're wild. They got a wingspan about 7 to 9 feet. Like I said, 4 feet tall. They can live about 45 years. So the cool thing about them is 80% of their diet is just bones and bone marrow.
Just bones, huh?
So they just, yeah. So what they'll do with two big bones, they'll fly them up in the air and they'll drop them till they shatter.
Yeah.
And so they can get smaller pieces to
eat. How big of bones are we talking about they can lift, like?
Oh, I mean,
a cow skull? Can they pick up like a skull?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Of a big animal though,
like
4 feet
tall birds. Like,
yeah,
they're big, they can do some damage. 80% of their diet is bones, so they'll literally just lift some bones up in the air, drop them, and shatter. And they even do. They also eat turtles sometimes too. There was actually a guy way back in the day, like
they crack the turtle's
shell, yeah, from dropping them in the air. There was a guy like way back in like Roman times that actually died from a vulture dropped a turtle, and the rumor was they mistook his bald head for like a rock, and they tried to drop the turtle shell on it, and it killed the guy because they just dropped the turtle on him. But, 80% of their thing is bones. They have a stomach acid pH of 1. So, like, the bones dissolve within 24 hours because that's just super acidic. That's as low as it goes if you know the pH scales, really. Eat bones. They like to rub their feathers in, like, iron-rich soil, which is what gives them that, like, orange, fiery look they have. And they don't really know why they do it because it's not for, like, camouflage or anything. The rumor is it's kind of like a status symbol kind of thing and just kind of looks cool. They're actually, like, really attracted to anything red. It's probably just instinctual because they, you know, they eat bones, so they're used to red. And they also sometimes their feathers will get, like...
By used to red, you mean, like, blood?
Yeah, so, like, it kind of attracts them to stuff. So they're really attracted to anything red, actually. And sometimes they do get the blood in their feathers, and that also makes their feathers look red.
I was going to say, this boy I'm looking at here, one of them's like red, and there's like a light orange that maybe looks like dried blood. The other one's like yellow.
Yeah, the orange is usually soil. They'll find like iron-rich soil, oxidized soil.
So are they usually just white?
Yeah, most of them are usually white, and they'll like all dye themselves, basically.
That's pretty cool.
They love eating bones, though.
I am a big fan of the bearded vulture so far. Do they have any of the zoos around here or anything? Do we know? Like, can I go see these anywhere, or are they all out in the wild?
There probably is some. They're actually not super hard to keep in captivity. One British guy used to even have one as a pet back in the day.
Really?
So they're probably at zoos around here. I'd have to check some of the zoos, you know, their animal listings. But, yeah, they're probably around here somewhere, or you can catch them in the wild. Well, kind of hard. They're a little endangered now, but they are native to Europe. They were overhunted for a while, so they're now endangered. But, super cool birds there. All right, the eye-eye.
I don't like the eye-eye.
Yeah, the eye-eyes are creepy. Native Madagascar people, like the Aborigines down there, it was always an omen if you saw an eye-eye. Because they're super nocturnal and they live up in trees, so it's super rare you see them. So, yeah, they always took it as a bad omen if you ran into one of those.
Yeah, this thing looks
around the Madagascar jungle.
This thing looks like it's sent from hell. It's like you said about the snakes last week or
the hellbender.
The snake fish. Yeah, like the hellbender feels a lot like the eye eye. You see that thing out when you're in the jungle or something, and you would think that that's a creature from hell coming to kill you.
Yeah, they get about they're like not even like super small either. They're like 3 feet long.
Is that why they're called the eye? Would people back in the days be like, aye, aye, pointing like aye?
Probably. Aye. That's probably actually where it comes from.
El Diablo, Diablo.
But they're on the east coast of Madagascar. They get about 3 feet long, so like they're not really super small either. They're the largest nocturnal primate, and they're a type of lemur, and they have weird rodent-like teeth that keep growing. And they have a specialized middle finger, which is super long and thin and, like, super skeletal looking. And so what they'll do with that finger is when they're hunting around at night, they'll tap on trees. And using that, they can locate where there's grubs and bugs inside the wood.
They're trying to feel to find something hollow, right?
Yeah.
They can then bust open,
I guess. So they can hear where if there's bugs in there from, like, how it responds to tapping. So if they find the bugs, they use those teeth and they just chew into the tree and use the finger to pluck the bugs out. And, they're super wild animals. They eat mostly bugs. They're endangered. They've had humans kill them because, you know, not surprisingly, people usually kill them when they see them because they think it's a bad omen and stuff like that.
I'm okay with people killing eye-eyes.
No, they're endangered now. But, and fusas eat them too, which is a mammal native to Madagascar. But it's only one of two animal species that uses that, like, tapping method to find food. I'm not quite sure of the other one, but, it's super unique for that, and it uses echolocation. It's the only primate that uses echolocation to find prey by doing that. They're creepy looking, man, but they, and their coloration changes, like, as they age. So they go from, like, that black to gray to white to yellowish to black. So it's weird.
This eye looks kind of cute. I think this one's in a house somewhere.
Oh, like a little baby one?
Yeah, well, not really a baby, just a pet, though. He's making a face like this. And his big ears
surprise
are poking out.
Surprise eye.
Yeah, like he's he's a house II and
house II. Those are nice.
But I can't imagine waking up to this thing, but man, some of these things.
They actually thought they went extinct in 1933.
I wish they would have. Imagine
they rediscovered them in 1957.
Imagine that they are all. Imagine you think all those are dead and you stumble across one. You'd be so scared. Like,
oh, yeah, especially if you're a native and like know the legends.
Aye, aye.
But yeah, no, they estimate there's only 1,000 to 10,000 left in the wild. They don't have an exact number of them yet either. But, yeah, they're super super creepy-looking animals, and they're actually not bad omens. That's false, but, yeah, only find them in the rainforest of Madagascar or if you catch them in a zoo.
I hope I never go to a zoo that has one.
I'm sure they're around somewhere.
I guess this is a sort of on-topic question, though. Mm-hmm. How drastically different is our zoo from other zoos? Like, is our zoo, would it be different than, like, much different than Ohio Zoo because of the climate and weather? Like, would, like, the Cincinnati
Sometimes,
Zoo and Knoxville Zoo?
Yes, yeah.
Would it be pretty similar or no? Like,
sometimes.
I'm sure the ones down in Florida would be closer to, like, what Madagascar is like. Yeah. The II's probably aren't here, but.
Yeah, you'll get more, like for, like you said, like, Florida, you'll get more of the, like, outside animals.
Okay.
Can, like. You get more like safari animals, you know, because they're more used to the temperatures, things like that, and they can let them outside more. Like, if you had one up in, like, Canada, you can't really have as many, you know, like, gazelles or
sure.
rhinos and stuff because you can't let them roam all the time because
sure.
it's cold. Like, you'd have to keep them inside somewhat.
Yeah,
so unless
that makes sense.
You got the money to have, like, the indoor housing, the temperature does sometimes, you know, determine what kind of animals you do or don't have. But, yeah, some of the zoos have, like... Like, most zoos almost all have elephants, and they'll just keep them inside at some point, which is weird because I
okay.
shouldn't really keep an elephant inside. But, yeah, it kind of fluctuates a little bit.
Okay. Good trip to your animal kingdom. We'll do that again next week. We'll play some Pump the Brakes or Keep Rolling coming up next.